Hey everyone, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim. And we should say that this show is dropping on August 8th, one day before the anniversary of Michael Brown's death.
Yeah, 3 years ago. And to be real, oftentimes media coverage of this type of thing comes with the typical playbook.
We talk to some experts, we talk to some residents, and we ask a whole bunch of people, has anything changed? What does the future hold? Are we starting to heal? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, there can be value in that, but it can also feel exploitive. Like the media only cares about issues of race and racism when it has what we call in the business a news peg.
So we're going to do something different.
Mm-hmm. In the month of August, in this podcast and in the one after this, we're going to be talking about art. Art and activism.
Art in its purest form is the way that we have figured out how to survive.
This is Dennis Allen. He's a New York-based playwright.
You know, whether it's the paintings on the inside of a cave, or the griots, telling stories, their oral history, through dance, through song, art has been the way to move us forward and give us a way to see ourselves.
In 2014, Dennis was part of a group of Black playwrights who created pieces for Hands Up, a stage production curated by Keith Joseph Atkins of New York's New Black Fest.
It was later adapted as a radio play for BBC4.
It's rare that you get to hear Black men speak their truth, unfiltered, unapologetic, and get a taste of what we're going through and our humanity, because it's usually filtered through many things, edited, so that it's palatable for what we call the white gaze.
On this episode, we're turning the podcast into a stage.
For the first time, American audiences will hear these radio adaptations of the Hands Up production.
And you'll get to know the authors themselves.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
Our first play is by Dennis Allen. He's the guy you just heard a couple minutes ago talking about how art is integral to our survival.
I wrote How I Feel.
Like all the other playwrights, all Black men, Dennis sat down to craft his work amid a series of highly publicized police killings of Black people.
Eric Garner had just happened. John Crawford had just happened at the Walmart in Ohio. So it was one of those situations where everyone's trying to process everything that was going on, particularly being a Black man in America. And so in trying to write the piece, what I found I needed to do was basically bring humanity to being a Black man in America. And one of the things that they do to dehumanize us, in my opinion, is they take away our ability to grieve, the full process to grieve. So it's, maybe you can be sad and depressed, but you could never, you could definitely never be angry. And so what I wanted to do, or one of the things that I wanted to do, is I wanted to give whoever read the piece, whether it was myself or another actor, the ability to be angry. Unapologetically angry about everything that was going on. And I also wanted to try and get the audience to experience the same experience of being uncomfortable.
And Dennis decided to use a very specific physical technique to make the audience uncomfortable.
We hold emotion in our bodies.
When his play, which runs around 10 minutes, is performed, in theaters, he asked the audience to hold their hands up the entire time.
And it was really interesting. One of the times that I performed, a woman pulled me to the side, a white woman pulled me to the side, and she was like, I wanted to keep my hands up, but it just made me feel too vulnerable, and I felt like a victim, so I had to put my hands down. And I was like, oh, I was like, well, that's... Just imagine having your hands up
your entire
life. Your entire life, exactly. But, you know, thank you for sharing that with me. I wrote that so that the actor could be unapologetically in their feelings. And so when I performed it, the first time I performed it, I found myself trying to make the audience feel safe. I found myself trying to make sure that the people knew that I was a safe Negro and that my fuck you wasn't really an aggressive fuck you. And I found myself trying to be like, oh, I'm not 50 Cent, I'm Will Smith, which is something that I see in my personal life. I used to work at Best Buy when I would help customers, particularly white customers, I could tell that I would make sure that my voice was a little bit lighter and that I was a little bit more articulate, and I would shrink myself up and I would make myself a little bit softer so that they would know that I was safe. And I think no one taught me that. No one told me that was the way to survive, but it's something that I think, you know, through experience and through passed down trauma, it's something that black men very much are finding themselves, especially black men of a particular height, particular color, performing all the time, constantly. When I performed the piece and I found myself doing the exact opposite of what I wrote the piece for, it was an aha moment of how conditioned we really are and how deep this thing goes. On a subconscious level, I'm always trying to make sure that I don't get shot. On a subconscious level, I'm always trying to make sure that I don't get ostracized. On a subconscious level, I'm always trying to make sure that I'm safe and that the people around me are safe. And it's a constant performance. And it's tiring. And I wrote the piece to kind of be able to be cathartic in a way.
This is How I Feel by Dennis Allen.
I'd like to start with the showing of solidarity. If you would, please raise your arm straight up in the air. I'm going to say, hands up. You respond with, don't shoot. So when I say hands up, you say, don't shoot. Hands up.
Don't shoot.
Hands up.
Don't shoot.
Hands up.
Don't shoot. Don't shoot. Don't shoot.
A few days into the protests after Mike Brown's death in Ferguson, I was at my girlfriend's apartment, watching the news coverage and following the Twitter updates.
Concluded that he was shot at least 6 times. We've got one to the very top of the head.
We both have been following the events closely for the past few days on almost a 24/7 vigilance. The room was filled to the ceiling with our angst and anger and fear and depression. So we decided to take a break, turn off the television and go offline. We sat silently for a second, and then she turned to me.
Baby, we never talked about how to handle it if we're out together and the police harass you. Like, what do you think I should do?
I'm looking at a woman I love. I see and feel her fear, and it's a fear that I'm all too familiar with. My mother has shared with me on a couple of occasions that when she was pregnant with me, she would find herself praying. She cried, tears filled with the shame and anger that only someone born into a world that doesn't value black lives can truly know.
I prayed that you wouldn't be a boy, because I knew that from the time you were born, you'd be born with a bullseye on your back.
So now, when I look at my girlfriend...
So what's the best way to keep you safe from the police?
I think about Mike Brown. Think about him being shot to death and then left in the street for 4.5 hours, uncovered for the entire neighborhood to see.
This is a problem. This is a child that was killed unjustly. He was shot in the back numerous times and left face down on the street, despite whatever he...
Think about the countless other names, the ones we know, the ones undocumented, beaten, tased, violated, shot, murdered at the hands of our so-called servers and protectors. I think about my girlfriend and my mother, worried night after night, hoping and praying that when I go out, I come home, because they know I'm the prey and it's open season out there. The fear that comes with knowing that you're not protected by those that are hired to protect you. Not only that, but They are targeting you, and it's illegal to protect yourself against those hired to protect you. Imagine a world where every single black or brown American only wore their Sunday best, all prayed to a Christian God, never said a cuss word, didn't do any drugs, not even prescription, and broke no laws. Never engaged in any violence whatsoever, all worked, never got on public assistance, no matter what the state of the job market was, and were never in debt. Imagine if black people were morally, spiritually, and financially better than any and every white person that has ever walked the earth. Perfect. Better than any human being has ever been. Then, and only then, could we rid our society of institutionalized racism, prejudice, and bigotry in America. Then, and only then, will white people see us as valuable human beings. Then, and only then, will we be able to see ourselves as valuable human beings. Imagine this world. What if I told you, if you could just keep your hands up high, we could create this utopia together? But you can never drop your hands. Hands up. For the sake of black people here in America and abroad, keep your hands up. Try. Try for a long time. No one can do it. No human can keep his or her hands up forever. And this bullshit fantasy isn't the answer either. I am human. My life is valuable, and I shouldn't have to keep my hands held high to prove it. And time again, keeping our hands held high hasn't gotten us treated like human beings should be treated. So how do I feel? Screw you. It's how I feel. I will not allow you to take away my humanity. Every time you tell me not to be angry, that I'm too aggressive, that I shouldn't be out at night, that I shouldn't wear a hoodie, and that I need to pull up my pants, and when I comply with your orders and reach for my wallet, you kill me anyway. When I drop to the ground and allow you to handcuff me, you shoot me anyway. When you put me in the back of the paddy wagon, you break my neck anyway. Screw you! Mike Brown was shot 6 times. He had no weapon. Brains were blown out in broad daylight. There is not language strong enough to convey what I feel about that. Screw you for not feeling what I feel. Screw you for shutting down because, yes, I'm using strong language because I'm not safe. My father's not safe. My brothers and sisters, my mother is not safe because none of you value our lives. Police don't. Whites don't. Blacks don't. But I will not allow you to take away my rights, my humanity. You indiscriminately killing me is a display of your power. Being willing to die for what I believe in is the display of mine. Hands up. Hands up. Hands up.
We want to spend a little bit more time with Dennis, the writer of the piece you just heard. And as a reminder, it came from the BBC Radio 4 adaptation of the play Hands Up.
Given that he wanted to bring humanity to the experience of being a black man in America, carve out space to be unapologetically angry about racism and the toll it takes.
And to shake audience members, especially the white ones, out of their comfort zones. So, did he feel like the version that was adapted for British audiences hit the mark?
Okay, unfiltered. Truthfully, I feel like the BBC version is what appropriation feels like sometimes. I feel like it is a version. It's not my version. I think they were attracted to a thing when they saw it in its purest form, and they got excited about it, and they produced it, and it's beautiful that they were willing to produce it. But I think it's also, I think there's a lack of understanding culturally on many levels about what they were really attracted to. So I feel about that about all the pieces. Now, again, all these pieces, including mine, are very personal. So I recognize that there's a bias on my end, but I also feel like, and I also realize that, you know, people don't want to get fined. So there are some edits that just can't be avoided. But the way that cuts and edits were made, I feel like it's somewhat a dampening down, and made them a little bit safer than I think they were meant to be. I'll speak just specifically for my own. It keeps the audience safe in a way that the piece, I didn't want anyone to feel safe and or comfortable when I wrote the piece. Because part of the problem is everyone's addicted to their comfort, and no growth was ever made in comfort.
All the pieces in Hands Up are intentionally personal monologues.
But what if you're a playwright and you're not sure you have something to say? Or what you have to say isn't really what people want to hear.
Our next piece tackles that. It's from Nathan Youngerberg, a Brooklyn-based photographer with Midwest roots.
I grew up in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is a town or city, a small city of about 50-some thousand people right along the Mississippi in southwestern Wisconsin.
Nathan's parents are white. He's an adoptee.
And he says this has often left him feeling like he's caught between two worlds, and feeling like he has to prove himself.
And I get it from both sides. You know, I feel like I get dismissed from white people all the time and have in the past, and also from other black people as well who, you know, hear the way that I speak or see the way that I talk or the way that I dress and want to dismiss me as not being conscious or aware of the reality of being black. So it's just part of my fabric of my life.
Participating in Hands Up, Nathan says, has been a major catalyst for his own personal healing.
Which started, I think, from when we did the table read before the first performance of this. And I was, again, so afraid that what I had to share wasn't going to offer anything compared to the experiences of my fellow playwrights. And after everyone was finished, you know, with the pieces being read, it was just like we all realized we were all in this together as black men, and that we were all supporting each other, and we were all champions for each other, and we were all there for each other on a creative and an emotional level. And that was just really huge for me to just feel like I was a part of that group.
From Nathan Youngerberg, this is Holes in My Identity.
I was just gonna bring my camera and take pictures and listen. It was a community discussion about Ferguson and the current state of black men in America, and I was afraid it was just gonna turn into another us against them, black versus white, never-ending argument. And I was also hesitant because I didn't think I would have anything else to share, because I've got all these holes in my identity from the lack of black culture, black experiences, black role models. I just got all these holes. In my mind, I half expected the Ferguson discussion to be filled to the rafters, hot and humid, with angry people screaming, fists raised in a heated frenzy. But what I found was a diverse group of 8 to 10 people sitting quietly in a circle of chairs. After an agonizing moment of silence, it began. A woman at the front spoke.
Welcome. I know that life is pretty heavy right now, so I want to urge you to use this space to speak to your experience, your pain, your anger, and don't hold back.
I am sick and tired of all this death.
I'm a teacher, junior high. I have a master's degree and a good job. And just last week, I took a group of my boys to an event in the city, and these cops, they mistook me for somebody else, and they pulled me aside, and they frisked me. They frisked me against a police car in front of my students.
I'm afraid to bring a child into this world, a son, Because having to worry each and every day if he's going to get shot by the police, it would kill me.
I can bet that there is not one black person in this room that hasn't been harassed by the police.
It's the media, man. They're always depicting us as the bad guy.
And then a woman, a white woman, sitting straight ahead. I'm giving her a qualifier because she went out of her way to announce that she was of Italian descent.
Well, I have been stopped and frisked at the airport several times. Four, to be exact. And it was absolutely humiliating. They rifled through my suitcase. I felt like a criminal. The fourth time it happened, I asked them why they singled me out. They told me that I fit a profile. Everybody gets singled out at least once in their life. It's not about race. We all go through it.
Nah, it's not the same.
Are you out of your mind? What we're talking about here is consistency. Repetitive profiling. Constant harassment. Consistency. And what you're saying is so dismissive.
How am I being dismissive?
Because when you're talking about issues of race, you can't just say that we all go through the same thing, because we don't.
Not the same.
Facts.
I was adopted by white parents and raised in an all-white, middle-class community, and outside of my never-ending identity crisis, my early life experience as a black American was extremely safe, extremely protected, and extremely dismissed. I would try so hard to articulate my feelings to my mom and dad, but they just didn't have the experience or understanding to support me. There was this incident at school where a kid was reading from a history book about Africa and he mispronounced the River Niger. You know how that ended. All the kids turned toward me and snickered, and my spirit just melted all over the floor. I went home that day crying, and my parents said,
"Oh, they didn't mean to hurt you."
When I was a kid, I had goofy hair, and the kids made fun of me, too.
Color doesn't matter.
Dismissed. I'm 43 years old, and I've never been stopped and frisked. I've never been accosted by the police. Profiling has not been a part of my experience. The more I've read and watched what was going on in Ferguson and the rest of the country, I just started to feel disconnected from my race because of my inability to relate to the experiences of other black men. And it kind of made me feel like a fraud. I remember a few years ago in Brooklyn, someone gave my partner a copy of The Little Black Book. It was a survival guide for black males in the U.S., what to do when confronted by the police. A few months ago, I was walking around the lake with my partner. He's bigger than me and darker than me and has an altogether polar opposite experience with race than I do. There was a white woman standing near us at a crosswalk. And when the light changed, she bolted.
Did you see that? She was shook, like, "I want to steal your purse. I got my own money, lady."
That wasn't what I saw. Why do you always think white women are running away from you? Maybe she was just late for work.
Are you serious? You didn't just see that. She looked at me, grabbed her purse, and then, oh, forget it. Just forget it.
I dismissed his feelings. And you know what was really going on? I was upset because from one black man to another, I couldn't understand what he was feeling, and I thought I should, and I stopped at the side of the lake for a moment to breathe. And then I told him what I wish my parents would have said to me. I told him that although I couldn't relate to what he was feeling, I heard him, and I was sorry. Because that's where the healing begins. That's where it begins.
Nathan, whose piece you just heard, is used to exploring questions of identity in his work. In fact, since writing the piece, he's gone even deeper.
His newest play just completed a run off Broadway. And it explores the afterlife of three young black men killed by the police and a civilian. But the hands-up play, he says, was different.
It was extremely painful, and I probably must have wrote like 30 different drafts, but Keith Joseph Atkins, who was the curator of the piece, was really good and really gentle as far as kind of peeling back the layers.
Nathan even rewrote the entire thing a week or two before the first performance. which happened just around the time that a grand jury here in Missouri decided not to indict Brown's killer, former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson.
And I just threw everything out on the table. And I also, secondly, too, had to, you know, reveal my sexuality and talk about, you know, being a gay man, because I refer to, at that time, my partner in the piece. And, you know, at one point I was trying to discuss that, just being a friend, and he's like, well, who is this friend? And I was like, man, do I have to, like, share all of this stuff? But I realized that by doing that, it was healing for me. And I knew then that if it was healing for me, if I was being completely authentic as myself as a writer and putting my authentic feelings on paper, dealing with the issues of race and all aspects of me, that somebody or people would find a way to connect to that and find a way to heal themselves.
Do you still feel like you have holes in your identity?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I probably will until I'm an old man, you know. I remember when I was getting ready to turn 30 and I had a conversation with my mom, and I had said that I wanted to have worked through all of this stuff by the time I turned 30, and she laughed, and, you know, she was probably in her 60s at that time, and she said, you know, I'm still working through stuff that I dealt with as a child, and she said that it's a lifelong process. And I definitely understand that, you know, that I will probably always have these holes within me, or at least one of them or two of them. But I think the older you get and the more experiences you have, and you really start to learn how to manage the holes a little bit better so you don't fall into them all the time.
Coming up, we hear another monologue from one of the Hands Up playwrights. So now we're going to bring you the final monologue from Hands Up.
But just as a reminder, this is just a fraction of the entire production, which these days is being performed in theaters across the country.
Just going to go ahead and say it would be nice if they're listening to bring a production here to St. Louis, just saying.
Indeed. The full production includes six men and now an additional piece from a Black woman playwright.
And a lot of these stories are actually longer than the audio versions we're bringing to you.
Yeah, but we'll make sure to put up links to these authors on our website, welivehere.show. Back to our final piece, though.
Like the ones you've already heard, it deals with anger and anguish, but also love. And most importantly, it explores what might happen when people are pushed to the extreme.
The name of the piece is Abortion.
Dear beautiful soul. Hey. It's me, Amen. I don't know you yet because technically you're not a person, and not in a physical sense. In fact, you're not even conceived. You're just an idea. Well, that's how my dad described where babies come from. I was about 6 years old.
Dad, where do babies come from?
Amen, babies are ideas waiting to be born. They live in two parts. Half of the ideas with a man and the other half with a woman. One day, when it's right, a man and a woman will come together and say, you know, we both got good ideas. Let's make one together. And not too long after that, the idea is born.
But Dad, not all ideas are good. Some are bad.
No idea is good or bad when it's born. It's only how we raise it.
Am I a good idea? Am I a good idea so far?
Yes, Amen, you are a wonderful idea.
I figured I'd take time now to talk to you, feed you with some love, because you are a wonderful idea. Now, before you get excited wanting to come out, there's some things I gotta tell you, lessons I've learned. People talk about love, but not about hate. If you love God, you gotta hate the devil. If you love freedom, you gotta hate bondage. Hate, like love, is dependent upon the user. It's like a lightsaber, and some will use it for good. But how do you know what's the greater good? I'm glad you asked. When life is affirmed. When life matters, you can go so far as to use death to make sure life can go on. and we call that sacrifice. It's honorable, sometimes. The only emotion I don't mess with is fear. Well, that one is like the worst of them all. You know the first thing I was afraid of? Those 17-year cicadas. Every 17 years, these little insects that have been living underground all this time suddenly bore holes from the earth and start flying around. Thousands of them. I mean, they come out for like 3 weeks or something just to mate. Mate and die. Ain't that crazy? They're big and they run into you, and the sound they make while they're flying, you get no sleep. I didn't want to go outside.
Son, why are you so afraid? They're not even thinking about you. They waited 17 years for this moment. They're just teenagers looking for a good time before they die. If they run into you, remember it was you that was in the way. All they want is love. Now get on outside and play.
And I stepped outside, and nothing happened. Do you know what blocked me? Fear. And somehow, whether it was through TV or movies or whatever, I had learned to be afraid of things that look different from me, even if they ain't worried about me, even if they just want sex. Love, man. Love and freedom have been going steady for a while. If you want freedom, you have to love so fiercely that you would lose yourself. Sacrifice. So, I guess this is the part where I gotta tell you why you'll never be born. At least not through me. I know, right? All this time telling you life lessons for a life you won't live. It's messed up, I know. But not without reason. How can I bring you into a world I haven't made better? I mean, what kind of father is that? I will not love you underground all this time, protecting you, shielding you from harmful lights and sounds, giving you all that I got, only to release you after 17 years so you can fly and be killed? Killed by some coward in a uniform and badge who don't know that you wasn't even thinking about him. I will not have you become my cicada. I'm sorry, dear soul, but I can't bring you here. Not until I've done my part and made the world better for you to be here. I know what you might think. Isn't this a bad idea? To strap explosives on your body to walk into a precinct to murder the murderers? Yes, it sounds like a bad idea. But if everybody worships and applauds sacrifice, if we all need someone to do what we're afraid to do, if we need someone to love so ferociously that they hate what might happen if we do nothing, well, I want to be that sacrifice. That's how much I love you. And when I'm done, while all them blue badges are rotting in hell for what they've done, I'm going to spend eternity looking to get a peek at love. Well, I gotta go. I hope you understand. Maybe you should wait 17 more years for things to change, but I promise you, this world will be different. I love you so much. Sincerely, your would-have-been father. Amen.
Amon puts on a jacket over his vest. He smiles and walks into the precinct.
So every time I listen to that one, it's just, it's super powerful.
Yes, and it also made us very curious about the man who wrote this final piece in Hands Up.
Hi, I'm Sangu Jikam. I am an actor and playwright and one of the playwrights for Hands Up.
Sangu got into the arts because of his brother.
He's an artist, a singer, and an actor, and I felt like, man, I would really love to do that. So I started auditioning for school plays and things, and eventually I got into Howard University in D.C. for acting. And I noticed a lot of my friends who were actors also wrote. And I said, wow, that's something I should pick up as well. And I didn't actually start writing until 2010, mainly because I wanted to cast myself. I didn't want to, you know, like wait for a casting director to call me and say, you booked it. I was like, well, if I write my own stuff.
You booked it.
I booked it. Exactly.
Sangu and his brother grew up in the suburbs of Baltimore. It was a pretty calm and quiet childhood, he says.
I have personally not had police brutality experiences. It's in here knocking on wood. But I work with young people a lot. And my students in the past have had experiences with police. That's the sad part. That no matter what I teach them, they walk outside and they're at risk for being accused of something that they didn't do.
Like the other playwrights, Sangu penned his piece just a few short weeks after teenager Michael Brown was killed here. He said he felt an intense need to respond as an artist and a responsibility to help things move forward.
I knew that I didn't want to write a piece that was necessarily about my own feelings in terms of the incident itself, but I wanted to write about at what point do people say enough is enough and they stop saying I'm going to protest and they stop saying I'm going to write my congressman and they stop saying I'm going to hold a town hall and they decide that the only way to deal with violence is with violence. Not saying that it's the right thing to do, but to say that, as Grandmaster Flash said, don't push me because I'm close to the edge.
Can I ask you, when you wrote that, did you feel close to the edge at all?
Yeah, I did. To me, what made me feel close to the edge was, one, our people have not been able to heal from the initial traumatic event of slavery. Two, we have faced continued oppression. And three, we've never been able to fully be active members of this society. I feel like we're like an afterthought or a addendum to the country. And when we say something, it's almost like our existence is a reminder of what had happened. And I was like, man, that what incenses me is that these killings are reminiscent of people escaping a plantation. These killings are representative of the destruction of Black Wall Street. These things are connected because we were brought here by force, and we're not really a part of the fabric.
This idea of fabric, Sangu says, is more than just some macro-level metaphor about society. It has to do with the fabric of a family.
And what people are willing to do to protect that family, which is why, Sangu says, most of the piece is meant to draw you into an intimate conversation between a father and a son.
We don't hear often about a man's relationship to his children. We don't often hear about a man's love for his children. And my parents have been married for about to be 51 years.
Wow.
And my dad was really the one, because of his work hours, who was able to take care of me and my brother until my mom got home from work. And so I grew up around men, uncles, teachers, cousins, who are loving men, and men who would do anything to make sure that their families are okay. And I thought in this piece, what's the role of love in deciding to give up your own life to save the destiny of a not yet born child?
Sangu says he doesn't have any kids yet. And if he does have them, he says he's hopeful their experience in this country can be different than so many before them.
But he says that at this moment in time, 3 years after a young man's death here in Ferguson compelled him to write Abortion, it's not clear.
Sadly, it hasn't changed much. I still don't have confidence in law enforcement. I still worry about my people and their survival. I worry about our healing from the traumas we have faced. I'm concerned that the country actually does not want Black people here in the United States, that we are not wanted, and that maybe we need to examine our relationship to this country. It seems rather abusive, and nobody recommends staying in an abusive relationship. I have watched more people die or be injured. Now it's like almost a weekly Facebook event that somebody's posting something about police profiling or brutality. And the cops don't care. They'll kill you on Facebook Live and still hold the gun as if you're going to do something after you've been shot. So if you just lay it all out, what is a reasonable person supposed to think about the existence of their people? I'm supposed to think that this country really does love us? Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Not by the behavior. You can't say you love me and then kill me. That doesn't make any sense. I am hopeful, though, for younger generations that that narrative is not true. But it's going to be a battle, and we should be prepared for how we are going to improve conditions in this country. And if America really does want Black people here for more than just entertainment and labor, if we really do matter, then you gotta act like it.
So guys, we gotta tell you, putting together this episode for you was a blast.
Great time, yeah.
These guys, these playwrights, are pretty cool dudes.
Yes, and so, they were very generous with their time. They gave
us lots
of time.
Very generous, quick to get in the studio. Thank you so much. We'll make sure that we put their info on our website so you can go follow them and catch up with the other cool stuff that they're doing these days.
Yeah, and we've got some formal stuff now. We need to let you know that what you heard were selections from a 45-minute drama called Hands Up, produced by Judith Kampfer of Corporation for Independent Media for BBC4. It was adapted from a stage production curated by Keith Joseph Atkins of New York's New Black Fest.
The production continues to be performed around the country, and the plays are published by Samuel French, Inc. For contact information for Corporation for Independent Media and the New Black Fest, visit the We Live Here website. And you guys know that, welivehere.show.
Yeah. All right. We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is the executive editor of St. Louis Public Radio and our editor.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.